A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about triage again, but this time he's asking about the pediatric version. He says we've talked about the discipline of medical triage and how first-line staff make those calls, but pediatric triage must be one of the hardest and most instructive disciplines there is. You take a patient population where some portion need urgent care, but a sizable chunk of that population can't talk, and another chunk can barely talk. So you've got the communication challenge of pediatrics layered on top of the heightened stakes of urgent care. His question is basically, how do these people, and the ones who specialize in emergency pediatrics, actually do what they do?
And the short answer is, they do it differently from adult triage in ways that aren't obvious until you've watched it happen. The longer answer is that pediatric triage is less a checklist and more a kind of calibrated pattern recognition that starts the second the family walks through the door.
So let's start with why this is different from adult triage, not just harder, but structurally different.
The first structural difference is who the historian is. In adult triage, the patient walks in and says, I have chest pain. It started 2 hours ago. It feels like pressure. It goes down my left arm. You get a narrative. In pediatrics, the patient might be 4 months old and the historian is a parent who hasn't slept in 2 days and is terrified. Those aren't the same data source.
The parent is the narrator, but the child is the plot.
And sometimes the parent doesn't know the plot. They may not have witnessed the onset. They might have picked the kid up from daycare and been told, oh, she felt warm this afternoon. That's the entire history. You're making acuity decisions on a sentence from a daycare worker filtered through a tired parent.
What's the second structural difference?
Physiology. Children's vital sign norms move with age in a way that adult numbers don't. A heart rate of 140 is completely normal in a 6-month-old and alarming in a 15-year-old. Respiratory rate, blood pressure, even the way they compensate for illness changes. An adult with sepsis tends to show it in their blood pressure fairly early. A child compensates for a long time. They vasoconstrict, their heart rate climbs, their breathing picks up, and their blood pressure stays normal until the moment it doesn't. Then they crash.
That's the thing people get wrong. They assume a child who looks okay on the monitor is okay.
And that's exactly the misconception that gets kids into trouble. Vital signs are the last thing to go in pediatric deterioration, not the first. The kid has been quietly working harder to breathe for 4 hours before the oxygen saturation drops. If you wait for the number to confirm what your eyes already told you, you've waited too long.
So, how do you assess a patient who can't tell you what's wrong and whose numbers lie to you?
You look at them. There's a tool called the Pediatric Assessment Triangle, the PAT, and it's the closest thing pediatric emergency medicine has to a universal first move. It evaluates three things, appearance, work of breathing, and circulation to skin. And you can do it in seconds without touching the child. It's designed to be hands-off because touching a sick kid can make them cry, and a crying kid looks worse than they are, which contaminates your assessment.
Appearance meaning what, exactly?
Is the child alert? Are they interacting with the environment? Are they making eye contact? Are they consolable? A child who's lying limp in a parent's arms and not tracking movement is a completely different patient from one who's crying loudly and reaching for things. The cry itself is data. A strong, vigorous cry tells you the airway is open and the kid has energy. A weak, high-pitched, or absent cry tells you something is very wrong.
Work of breathing is the second leg.
You're watching for retractions, nasal flaring, head bobbing, grunting. A child who's using accessory muscles to breathe is compensating. They're working hard to maintain oxygenation, and that work is visible from across the room. You don't need a stethoscope to see a kid's chest pulling in under the ribs.
And circulation to skin?
Color, temperature, capillary refill. Pale, mottled, or cyanotic skin is a red flag. A kid who's warm and pink with a normal capillary refill is perfusing adequately. A kid who's gray and cool with a capillary refill of 4 seconds is not.
4 seconds. That's the kind of number that sticks with you.
and the PAT gives you a gestalt in about 5 to 10 seconds. It's not a diagnosis, it's a sorting tool. It tells you whether this child is sick or not, sick in a way that formal vital signs might not yet reflect.
That phrase, sick or not sick, it sounds almost anti-clinical, like something you'd hear from a veteran nurse who's seen 10,000 kids and just knows.
And there's actual work on this. Experienced pediatric emergency physicians form an immediate impression, a gestalt, that predicts admission better than some formal scoring systems. It's not mysticism. It's pattern recognition built from thousands of exposures. The brain is doing something like a Bayesian update on features the clinician may not even be able to articulate. The child's posture, the quality of the cry, the way the parent is holding them, the speed with which the parent walked from the waiting room to the triage bay.
The parent's walk speed is data.
It absolutely is. A parent who sprints carrying a limp child is communicating something different from a parent who strolls with a kid who's whining about wanting a snack. The whole encounter is information. And experienced triage nurses read all of it.
What about the formal scoring systems, the ones designed to make this reproducible?
There's the Pediatric Observation Priority Score, POPS, which is a validated early warning score used in some emergency departments. It takes things like respiratory rate, heart rate, oxygen saturation, behavior, and gives you a number. And it's useful, but it's an adjunct. It's not a replacement for clinical judgment. A child can score below the threshold and still be deteriorating. The score is a snapshot, and pediatric deterioration is a moving picture.
So the scoring system is like a photograph, and the gestalt is more like watching the film.
That's a fair way to put it. And the reason the gestalt matters so much in pediatrics specifically is that children change fast. An adult with pneumonia tends to follow a fairly predictable trajectory. A 6-month-old with bronchiolitis can look okay at 10 in the morning and be in respiratory failure by 2 in the afternoon. The reassessment interval has to be shorter.
Give me a concrete case. What does this actually look like at the triage desk?
6-month-old comes in with bronchiolitis. The parent says the baby has been feeding poorly for the last 12 hours. Oxygen saturation is 96%, which is fine. Heart rate is a little high, but within range for age. Respiratory rate is elevated, but not terrifying. The numbers say, watch and wait. But the baby is lying in the parent's arms, not making eye contact, not reaching for anything, with a weak cry and some nasal flaring. The experienced nurse looks at that baby and says, this kid is sick. They're working hard to compensate, and the poor feeding tells you they don't have reserve. That baby gets a bed and close monitoring, not a chair in the waiting room.
And the reverse?
A 3-year-old with a fever of 40 degrees, which sounds terrifying to a parent. The kid is running around the waiting room playing with a toy, drinking juice, and arguing with their sibling. The numbers are scary, but the child is compensating beautifully. That kid is less urgent than the quiet 6-month-old, even though the temperature is higher. Fever itself isn't the danger in most otherwise healthy children. The danger is what the child looks like while they have the fever.
So the thermometer is lying, in a sense.
The thermometer is telling the truth about one variable. But triage isn't about one variable, it's about the whole picture. And the whole picture includes how the child is behaving, which the thermometer can't measure.
Let's talk about the communication piece more directly. A pre-verbal infant can't say, my chest hurts when I breathe. A toddler might have the words, but not the understanding. What do you actually do with each age group?
For pre-verbal infants, you're entirely dependent on observation and parent report. You watch the breathing, the color, the interaction. You ask the parent about feeding, about wet diapers, about sleep patterns, about whether the cry sounds different from usual. Parents know their child's baseline in a way no clinician ever can. A parent who says, this cry is different, this isn't her normal cry, that's high-value information.
The parent is the diagnostic instrument.
They are, and they're also the thing that needs calibration, because a first-time parent might be terrified by a normal cry, while a parent of 4 might underreport because they've seen it all before. Triage staff have to weigh the parent's anxiety against the child's appearance. An anxious parent with a well-appearing child is a different situation from an anxious parent with a child who looks off. The first is a communication problem. The second is a clinical problem.
Toddlers are the tricky middle ground.
Toddlers have words, but not reliable ones. They might say their tummy hurts when they actually mean they're scared or they don't like the room. They might answer yes to every question because they want to please the adult. You can't do a standard pain history with a 2-year-old. You have to watch where they put their hands, how they move, whether they're guarding a body part. A toddler with appendicitis might not say, "I have pain in my right lower quadrant." They might just curl up and refuse to walk.
And school-age kids?
School-age children can describe symptoms, but they underreport. They're scared of needles, scared of being kept in the hospital, scared of disappointing their parents. A 7-year-old might say their pain is a 2 out of 10 when it's actually a 7 because they don't want a shot. You have to read the body language alongside the words. The child who says they're fine while holding perfectly still and breathing shallowly isn't fine.
So each developmental stage requires a different assessment approach, and the triage nurse has to switch between them in the space of minutes.
That's the cognitive load. You're not just sorting patients, you're switching between entirely different communication modalities, each with its own failure modes. And you're doing it under time pressure with a waiting room full of families watching you.
Let's get into the stakes. What happens when the communication challenge meets the urgent care pressure?
The stakes multiplier is the compensation, then crash pattern. A child can maintain normal blood pressure and heart rate while quietly deteriorating for hours. The vital signs look reassuring right up until the moment they don't. And when they don't, the crash is sudden and severe. That means triage staff can't wait for the numbers to confirm what their eyes already suspect. If the child looks sick, they're sick until proven otherwise.
So the threshold for caution is deliberately low.
Under triage is the nightmare scenario. Missing a sick child is far worse than overclassifying a well child. If you over-triage, you've used a bed and some resources unnecessarily. If you under-triage, a child might die in the waiting room. The asymmetry of harm is brutal. Every pediatric triage protocol is designed around that asymmetry.
And that's why the Gestalt gets so much weight, because the cost of ignoring it's catastrophic.
And here's the thing about the Gestalt. It's not perfectly reproducible. Two experienced nurses might triage the same child differently. One might see a kid who's a little off and escalate. Another might see a kid who's a little off but stable and decide to watch. Both are reasonable. The goal isn't perfect consistency, it's safe outcomes. And in a system where the downside of missing something is so severe, you accept a certain amount of variability in exchange for sensitivity.
That's a hard thing to explain to a hospital administrator who wants standardized protocols.
It is, and it's a real tension. Triage systems are designed to be systematic and reproducible, but pediatric assessment relies heavily on tacit clinical judgment that's hard to codify. You can write a protocol for the PAT. You can write a protocol for POPs. You can't write a protocol for the feeling you get when a parent walks in holding a child a certain way and you just know something's wrong.
How do specialists actually build that judgment? What's the training path?
It's built through exposure. Large volumes of patients, feedback on outcomes, and mentorship from senior clinicians. You see 1,000 kids with fever, and you learn which ones look worrying and which ones don't. You get feedback when you're wrong, and that feedback sharpens the pattern recognition. Simulation training helps, but the Gestalt is learned at the bedside. There's no shortcut.
That creates a workforce problem.
It does. Not every urgent care setting has staff with pediatric-specific training. A nurse who's excellent at adult triage might not have the pattern recognition for kids. And as urgent care expands and pediatric emergency departments face staffing shortages, the question of who's qualified to triage children becomes more pressing. You can't just put any nurse at the pediatric triage desk and expect the same outcomes.
What about the parent-provider dynamic? That seems like its own whole layer.
Parents aren't neutral observers. They're frightened, often sleep-deprived, sometimes carrying previous traumatic medical experiences. A parent who had a bad experience in an emergency department 5 years ago might be hypervigilant now. A parent who's been dismissed by clinicians before might overstate symptoms to be taken seriously. Triage staff have to simultaneously assess the child and manage the parent's anxiety. Because an anxious parent can escalate the encounter, consume resources, and make it harder to assess the child calmly.
The parent's anxiety is contagious.
And the child picks up on it. A child who was calm becomes distressed when the parent is distressed. So you have this feedback loop where the parent's fear makes the child look sicker, which makes the parent more afraid. Breaking that loop is part of the triage skill set. Sometimes the most clinically useful thing you can do is calm the parent down so you can see the child clearly.
What about the parent whose concern is being dismissed? I imagine that's a real source of error.
It's a known failure pattern. A parent says, "Something is wrong. I know my child. This isn't normal." The triage nurse looks at the child, sees a kid who's running around and playing, and downgrades the concern. Most of the time, the nurse is right. But occasionally, the parent is picking up on something subtle that hasn't manifested clinically yet. The parent knows the baseline. The nurse doesn't. Good pediatric triage takes parental concerns seriously, even when the child looks well. It doesn't mean you escalate every worried parent, but it means you don't dismiss them reflexively.
There's a phrase for this. Calibrated suspicion.
That's exactly what experienced pediatric emergency physicians describe. You assume the worst until proven otherwise, but you use repeated reassessment to refine your judgment. A child who looks better after antipyretics or fluids can be downgraded. A child who looks the same or worse is escalated. It's not a one-time decision. It's a process that continues through the emergency department stay.
And that requires the staff to actually reassess, which takes time, which is in short supply.
Crowding is the enemy of good pediatric triage. When the waiting room is full and the staff are stretched, the reassessment interval lengthens. A child who was triaged as stable 2 hours ago might be deteriorating now, but nobody has looked at them again. That's how kids get into trouble. The initial triage was fine, but the follow-up didn't happen.
So the system pressure isn't just about the initial decision. It's about the ongoing monitoring.
And that's where the deliberate low threshold for caution comes in. If you're not sure you'll be able to reassess in a timely way, you escalate more aggressively. It's a hedge against the system's inability to watch everyone closely.
Let's talk about telehealth, because that's the emerging piece. Can remote triage work for kids?
It's limited. You can assess some things over video. You can see the child's color, watch their breathing, observe their interaction with the environment. But you can't do capillary refill. You can't feel skin temperature. You can't listen to the chest. And the parent is holding the camera, which means the parent is framing what you see. A parent who's worried might show you the child at their worst. A parent who's minimizing might show you the child at their best. The camera is a filter.
The parent is the cinematographer.
And the cinematographer has an agenda, even if it's unconscious. The in-person gestalt relies on unfiltered observation. Telehealth can't replicate that. It's better than nothing, and it's useful for follow-up, but it's not a replacement for the bedside assessment.
What about the knock-on effect of all this? The fact that triage decisions aren't perfectly reproducible, that two nurses might disagree.
That's inherent to assessing patients who can't self-advocate. An adult can say, "I feel worse than I did an hour ago." A six-month-old can't. So you're always working with incomplete information, and reasonable people will fill in the gaps differently. The goal isn't perfect consistency. It's safe outcomes. And a system that accepts some variability in exchange for sensitivity is doing exactly what it should be doing.
But that's a hard sell in an era of standardization and quality metrics.
It is, and it creates a real tension. Hospital administrators want reproducible processes. They want to know that every child who comes through the door is triaged the same way. But the reality is that pediatric triage is a craft, not an algorithm. You can standardize the tools, but you can't standardize the judgment, and pretending otherwise is dangerous.
So what does the future look like? As urgent care expands and pediatric emergency departments face shortages?
The question of who's qualified to triage children becomes more urgent. We're seeing more pediatric patients in general, urgent care settings, where the staff may not have pediatric-specific training. That's a risk. The gestalt that a pediatric emergency nurse has built over 10 years doesn't transfer automatically to a general urgent care nurse. The system needs to either route pediatric patients to pediatric-trained staff or train general staff more explicitly in pediatric assessment.
And the training piece is hard because the gestalt is learned at the bedside, not in a classroom.
Simulation helps. You can expose people to high-fidelity scenarios that mimic the sick child presentation. But simulation is a supplement, not a substitute. The real learning happens when you see 10,000 kids and get feedback on your calls. There's no shortcut to that.
Let's step back and think about what this discipline teaches us more broadly. Daniel said pediatric triage might be the most instructive discipline of all. Is he right?
There's a case for it. Pediatric triage forces you to make high-stakes decisions with incomplete information, where the primary source can't communicate and the secondary source is emotionally compromised. That's not just medicine. That's any situation where you're responsible for someone who can't advocate for themselves and you have to act anyway.
The parent is the proxy, and the proxy is unreliable in predictable ways.
But also reliable in ways that matter. The parent knows the baseline. The parent knows when something is different. The trick is calibrating how much weight to give that knowledge against the parent's emotional state. And that calibration is itself a skill that takes years to develop.
So the discipline is really about managing uncertainty under pressure, with multiple imperfect information sources.
Doing it fast. The triage nurse has minutes, sometimes seconds, to make the call. They can't run a full assessment, they can't wait for labs, they have to look, listen, and decide. That's the craft.
I want to come back to something you said earlier about the child compensating until they crash. That seems like the single most important fact for parents to understand.
It's the thing I wish every parent knew. A child can look okay and be quietly deteriorating. The vital signs are the last thing to go. So if your child looks off to you, if they're not acting like themselves, if they're not feeding or not interacting the way they normally do, that's the warning sign. Don't wait for the fever to spike or the oxygen to drop. The behavior is the signal.
That's the practical takeaway for anyone with a kid.
It's the reason pediatric triage exists as its own discipline. You can't rely on the numbers. You have to read the child. And reading the child is something that humans are uniquely good at, which is why the gestalt matters so much.
I'm going to push on that a little. If humans are uniquely good at reading children, why is the gestalt so hard to teach? Why can't we just train everyone to do it?
Because the gestalt is built from thousands of exposures with feedback. It's not a rule you can state. It's a pattern your brain learns implicitly. You can tell someone, look for nasal flaring and retractions, and that helps. But the feeling that this child is sick in a way I can't quite articulate, that only comes from seeing enough sick children and enough well children to know the difference at a glance. It's like learning to read a face. You can't teach someone to read a face with a checklist.
It's tacit knowledge in the truest sense.
That's why the workforce challenge is real. You can't just hire more nurses and expect them to have the gestalt. You have to grow them. Which takes time and mentorship and volume. And in a system that's already short-staffed, that's a hard ask.
I did a year as a night shift registration clerk at a pediatric urgent care. 1994. I was the first person the family saw when they came through the door. No clinical training. I checked them in, took their insurance cards, asked them to fill out forms. But after a few weeks, I started noticing things. A parent who couldn't stop crying while they filled out the form. A kid who was limp in a car seat and didn't react when the automatic door made that ding. A teenager who wouldn't make eye contact and answered every question in monosyllables. I started flagging the charts. Just a sticky note on the front. Something like, Mom very upset, or kid too quiet. The nurses never asked me to do it. They just started reading the notes.
You build your own gestalt from the desk.
I had a notebook. I called it desk flags. Every time my gut said something was wrong before any clinical assessment, I wrote it down. I never knew the outcomes. The nurse would take the chart, and the family would disappear into the back, and I'd never hear what happened. But there was one kid, 3 years old. The mom brought him in at 2 a.m. He was asleep in her arms, but he was too still. Not normal sleep. I flagged the chart. Later I heard he had meningitis. I don't know if my note made any difference. The nurse probably would have caught it anyway, but I still think about that kid.
You were doing exactly what we've been describing. Reading the family's presentation as data. The parent's affect, the child's behavior, the whole scene.
Nobody taught me. I just watched enough families come through that door that the ones who were different stood out. And the thing is, the triage decision often started before the nurse ever saw the child. I was the first filter. If I flagged a chart, the nurse looked at it differently.
That's a layer we hadn't considered. The triage process begins at the front desk, with people who have no clinical training but develop their own gestalt anyway.
The sticky notes were cheap. The notebook was a spiral thing from the drugstore. I think it cost $1.99, but it was the most useful thing I had at that job.
Did you ever find out if the nurses actually used your flags?
One of them told me once that she read them before she called the next patient. She said sometimes the note made her bring a kid back sooner than she'd have otherwise. That's all I know.
The gestalt isn't just a clinical skill. It's a human skill that shows up anywhere people are watching, other people for signs of trouble.
The desk was a good place to watch. You saw everyone who came in, the ones who were fine, the ones who weren't, and the ones who were trying to decide if they should be there at all. After a while, you could tell the difference between a parent who was worried about nothing and a parent who was worried about something. The second kind moved differently.
That's the thing about pediatric triage. It's not just the nurse's job. It's distributed across everyone who touches the family before the clinical assessment begins. The receptionist, the security guard, the volunteer who walks them to the waiting area. They all see things.
I wasn't a clinician. I was just the guy at the desk. But I saw enough to know when something was off, and I wrote it down. That's all I did.
The one thing I'm taking from this is that pediatric triage is a craft built on pattern recognition, and the pattern recognition extends further than the clinical team. It starts at the front door. The whole system is reading the child, whether the system knows it or not.
The open question is how you train that craft in an era of high turnover and staffing shortages. If the gestalt is built through years of exposure and mentorship, what happens when the experienced people leave and the new people don't have time to accumulate the same volume? Can remote triage ever replicate the in-person assessment? What happens when urgent care settings without pediatric expertise are the first contact for a sick child?
Those are the questions that keep emergency pediatricians up at night, I'd imagine.
They should. Because the discipline works, but it works because of people who've spent years learning to read children. If we lose that, we lose something that protocols and scoring systems can't replace.
If you found this interesting, leave a review. It helps other listeners find the show.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts.
Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.